the bleachers to the other like a covered bridge, and the beautiful handcrafted posters ringing the walls. It was time to go to school, at least for some students. Understandably heady from the experience of the Friday morning pep rally, Don Billingsley's focus was on the game ahead, not on school. Not all the weekly pep rallies were as rousing as this one had been, but it was always hard to concentrate after them. "I don't do much on Fridays," he said as he sauntered off to class in his black jersey with the number 26 on it. And even if he had felt otherwise about it, there wasn't a heck of a lot to do anyway. School was just there for Don. A couple of classes to fill up time that offered virtually no challenge whatever. And he was the first to admit that if he was learning anything his senior year, it was a miracle. His schedule that day included sociology class, in which he watched a video of a Geraldo Rivera television special succinctly titled Murder, while munching on fresh-baked cookies that he had been given during the pep rally. As his class instruction that day, he listened to an interview with the noted criminal theorist Charles Manson, and heard relatives of crime victims make such intellectually stimulating comments as, "I would like to see him die in the electric chair. He doesn't deserve to live." It included photography, with the class spending the period learning how to feel comfortable in front of a television camera. When it was his turn, Don dutifully rose to the challenge by successfully mouthing the scripted words, "This is Don Billingsley. Headline news next." It included English, where the class spent the first 10 minutes going over the homework assignment for Monday, and the next 45 minutes doing the homework assignment for Monday. It included food science, this particular lesson being on correct menu form and the question of what one should place first on the menu when writing it out, shrimp cocktail or jello salad. "This is what I do all day," said Billingsley, as he grappled with the shrimp cocktail versus jello issue, moments before plunging into the far murkier ground of the appropriateness of listing cream of tomato soup and grilled cheese sandwich on the same line. "All I do in class is show up. They should make these classes 15 minutes long. Last year in English, I had to work. This year, it's like, teach me something before I go to college." Not all classes were like this, but even in accelerated courses, the classroom at Permian was hardly a hotbed of intellectual give and take. It was not uncommon for teachers at Permian to teach for only a quarter or a third of the period and then basically let students do whatever they wanted as long as they did it quietly. It was also unusual to find teachers who demanded from students their very best, who refused to succumb to the notion that there was no reason to challenge them because they simply didn't care. When there was a novel approach in the classroom, it was geared for a generation indisputably weaned on the fast foods of television and the VCR, not the written word. To get students to learn history, one teacher played a version of Jeopardy. Another teacher in an honors English course, instead of having the students read The Scarlet Letter one year, showed them a video of it. Many teachers felt that no matter how creative they were in the classroom, it wouldn't make a difference anyway. They talked about a devastating erosion in standards, how the students of today bore no resemblance to the students of even 10 or 15 years ago, how their preoccupations were with anything but school. It was hard for teachers not to feel depressed by the lack of rudimentary knowledge, like in the history class in which students were asked to name the president after John F. Kennedy. Several students meekly raised their hands and proffered the name of Harry Truman. None gave the correct answer of Lyndon Johnson, who also happened to have been a native Texan. In 1975, the average SAT score on the combined math and verbal sections at Permian was 963. For the senior class of 1988 to 89, the average combined SAT score was 85 points lower, 878. During the 70s, it had been normal for Permian to have seven seniors qualify as national merit semifinalists. In the 1988-89 school year, the number dropped to one, which the superintendent of schools, Hugh Hayes, acknowledged was inexcusable for a school the size of Permian with a student body that was rooted in the middle class. A year later, with the help of $15,000 in consultants' fees to identify those who might pass the required test, the number went up to five. Some teachers ascribed the drop in academic performance to the effects of court-ordered desegregation as well as a rapid increase in the town's Hispanic population. In 8 years, Permian had gone from being a virtually all-white school to one where the proportion of minorities in the student body was about 30%. In hush-hush tones, some teachers blamed the school's woes on the Mexicans or on the blacks, even though the school still very much had the look and feel of a white suburban high school, its parking lot filled with new and shiny cars, the majority of its students dressed in striking outfits. Some teachers blamed the erosion on the effects of the economic downturn in the oil patch, which had dealt Odessa a crippling blow. Some blamed it on the breakdown of the family unit. More and more kids were living with single parents who had to work morning, noon, and night just to make ends meet and didn't have the time or the inclination to promote the virtue of doing well in school. Some blamed it on parents who seemed much less interested in pushing their kids in the classroom than in football or band or choir. Some blamed it on themselves, acknowledging that the passion they had had for teaching 20 years ago had run dry. Some blamed it on recent educational reforms passed in Texas that, instead of making the classroom more stimulating, more creative, had done just the opposite by turning the teacher into a glorified clerk, forced to follow an endless series of rules and procedures. Despite the litany of possible reasons, it was hard not to wonder if the fundamental core of education, the ability of teachers to teach and the ability of kids to learn, had gotten lost. Its problems didn't make Permian a bad school at all, just a very typically American one. It still amazes me when I give a test in grammar and the kids can do it, said English teacher Elodia Hilliard, with more than a touch of sadness in her voice. It used to be the other way around. I used to be surprised whenever they didn't know it. Now I'm amazed when they do know it. When Hilliard looked around the classroom, she saw students with no direction, and she wondered if they saw any point at all at being well-read and intelligent. She listened to parents who, rather than promising to try to motivate their children, made excuses for them. The homework was too hard, or the book they had been assigned had too many cuss words in it. Even when she got them to read, the leap to conceptual creative thinking seemed as far off as a trip to Jupiter. It almost seemed to her and other teachers as if students were scared of it. There was a time when she had had unflappable faith in her profession, when she had encouraged the best and brightest to follow in her footsteps and spread the gospel of literature and grammar with evangelical zeal. But not anymore. I really felt we made a difference, she said one day in her classroom, devoid of the usual corner shrine to mojo, but instead decorated with lovely posters illustrating the meanings of hyperbole, oxymoron, metonymy, and personification. Now I'm beginning to wonder. I don't know. I'm really uncertain. She bent over backward not to be negative, but she had a view of students she couldn't suppress. They like to have cars. They like stereo speakers that are fancy. They like to go skiing. They like to wear good jewelry. In her mind, students seemed in search of only one thing. Having fun is what it's all about. Jane Franks, who had been teaching for 31 years and eagerly counted off the days until her retirement at the end of the year, felt the same way. Today's students had become enigmas to her. They weren't disrespectful, they weren't obnoxious, they weren't demanding. It wasn't that they were good kids or bad kids or any kind of kid at all. That would have been much better than what they were now, deadened to themselves and to the world around them. These kids don't take responsibility or don't know how, she said. Kids used to worry about where they were going to fit into the world. Kids today don't seem to worry if they're going to fit in society because they don't give a hoot. 20 years ago, I was working my kids to death. And now, I have to remind my seniors to use capital letters and put periods at the end of sentences. They don't seem to care about their grades. They don't seem to care about each other. They seem to care about having a good time, but don't know how to define good. I don't know what young kids are about. I can't get in their minds. I used to. Like others, Jane Franks looked around for people and things to blame. But sitting in the teacher's lounge one day, her voice soft and weary, she decided the fault might be with herself. A fundamental change had taken place in the classroom. It wasn't a place to learn anymore, but a way station, and maybe she was responsible for that. I'm tired. I think I'm tired of being ineffective. I must not be doing it right, because I don't have a sense of satisfaction. I don't have the close friendships with the kids I used to. I used to encourage my good students to be teachers because it was so rewarding. I don't do that anymore. When I first started teaching, I felt, my God, this must be like being a pro ball player, getting paid for something I love. It was where I was supposed to be. If school was boring, Don Billingsley nevertheless did his best to get through it. When the food science teacher made the fatal mistake of asking the class if it knew the meaning of the word condiment, Don immediately answered with, lambskin, sheepskin. All joking aside, Don was becoming something of a food science scholar. He had scored a superb 99 on the fill-in-the-blank worksheet on cakes and frostings, not to mention a 96 on his poultry worksheet. The preparation and service worksheet was coming a little more slowly. He had gotten only a 60. But there seemed little doubt that Don would eventually get a handle on it, and, of course, when the occasion arose to write out a menu for a black tie dinner party in Odessa, he would know exactly what to do. In English, where one of the blackboard panels had a list of questions about Macbeth and another a reminder to bring a flashlight to the pep rally, Don had uncovered one of the great secrets of the class with the discovery that if he angled his chair in a certain way behind the other students, the teacher couldn't see him fall asleep. "You like to sleep? This is where I sleep," he said just before he entered the classroom. A worksheet was due that day, deciphering the meaning of some lines from Macbeth, and Don was handed a copy of the homework by someone else so he could copy down the answers. The class time was supposed to be spent doing a little crossword puzzle on the play, but Don didn't do much of it, and it didn't seem to matter. The instructor, for her part, believed that the text the students used, Adventures in English Literature, which contained selected works by Shakespeare, Edmund Spenser, and Daniel Defoe, among others, was too hard for them. She said also that they absolutely hated any assignment in which they had to interpret what they had read. If they had to think about anything, make critical judgments and deliberations, the cause was hopeless. The best they could be expected to do was regurgitate. In sociology, Don generously passed around his bag of cookies. He and the other students watched eagerly as accounts of one gruesome murder after another passed over the tiny VCR screen, accompanied by the hushed melodrama of Geraldo Rivera. The teacher gave no instruction the entire period, except to applaud the actions of a man who, in broad daylight at an airport, killed a manacled criminal suspect accused of molesting the man's son. Don, of course, was a football player, which gave him special status among his peers, regardless of how he performed in class. In the hierarchy of the school, where girls and partying and clothes and fancy cars were as important as academics, being a football player opened doors that other students could only dream of. All other achievements seemed to pale in the face of it. Eddie Driscoll, a wonderfully articulate student, ranked number 2 in the senior class, loved to read and debate and throw out ideas. He stood out in class like a sore thumb. There were some who admired him and others who considered him a pompous windbag. Despite all his academic accomplishments, Eddie himself often wondered what it would be like to sit in those 2 rows at the front of the pep rally each Friday in a brotherhood as supremely elite as Skull and Bones at Yale or the Porcellian Club at Harvard. Such musings didn't make him resentful of the football players. He liked them. He just felt a little envious. No matter how many books he read, no matter how exquisite his arguments in government class about gun control or the Sandinistas or the death penalty, he never got the latest scoop on who was having the weekend parties. Only the football players were privy to that sacred knowledge. "The football identity is so glorious," he said. "I always wondered what it would have been like if I had been a football player. I think it'd be great to be in the limelight and be part of the team, have a geisha girl bring me candy 3 times a day." Rocky Pierce, who had graduated from Permian in 1988 and was going out with starting defensive quarterback Caudy Dean, said there was definitely a mystique in the school about dating a Permian football player. "Everybody's into football. Football is the sport. I wouldn't say it's an honor or anything, but it's looked up to." "Wow, you're going out with a football player, a Permian football player." Rocky had been chosen a pepette her senior year. Lots were drawn to see which player each pepette would be assigned to for the season. Some of the players were obnoxious and egotistical, but Rocky didn't really mind as long as it was a football player she got and not one of the student trainers. Nobody wants a trainer. You want a football player. She had ended up being assigned to Caudy, who was then a junior. At the watermelon feed that year, she hadn't worn his number on her jersey, which angered him. But they hit it off well. "I liked him. Plus, I wanted to be a real good pepette. I didn't want him to think I was a bad pepette. I wanted to be a good pepette." She brought Caudy an ice cream cake in the shape of a football field from Baskin-Robbins. She baked him cakes and brownies. She got him a black trash can and filled it with popcorn balls. She gave him a towel and pillowcase decorated with the insignia of Mojo and Texas. After several months, they went on a date and then started going out steadily. From time to time, the role of the pepette became controversial. A stinging editorial in the school newspaper, the Permian Press, applauded a new rule prohibiting pepettes from placing candy in players' lockers every Friday. "Though losing a tradition, pepettes have gained much respect," said the editorial. "No longer will a member be the personal geisha girl of a player. Instead, she can focus more on the organization's original purpose, boosting morale. And in so doing, she will carry the image of professionalism she deserves for her work bolstering the famous Mojo spirit." But the pepettes still spent time baking players' cookies and making them signs. Since they could no longer put goodies in the lockers of the players, they just handed the stuff to them instead, or dropped it off at their houses. Their role was symptomatic of the role all girls played at Permian. You hate to admit it in this day and time, but a lot of girls are conditioned towards liberal arts courses rather than engineering and science, said Callie Tave, who found herself perpetually buried under a blizzard of forms and recommendation requests since she was the only college counselor for the 700-member senior class. The attitude the girls at Permian seemed to have about themselves was reflected during an economics class one day when Dorothy Fowler